one of the most intense radios I've ever seen. And, you know, I mean, it's going for the price of a sport car. Of course, you'd get far less miles with it, I'm sure. But, yeah, if I had $15,000 to burn on a radio, I probably wouldn't have to sit here on a Sunday night, right? KD2HC, back to that.
Steve, you keep forgetting and you keep hitting that microphone very hard. You're going to have to really turn down that gain control. But what you did is you backed away another inch, and then you forgot and did it again. So you're hitting the audio very hard. You got to turn that gain control down. You're starting to make square waves. We heard everything you said, don't worry. But good information. 15,000. Wow. I can't believe they sold many of those. A buddy of mine just came back from Dayton. I got to ask him what's the most expensive piece of equipment he saw at Dayton. 15 grand for a Kenwood Super Rig. I imagine that's got all kinds of digital signal processing, software control, all kinds of waterfall displays. It's probably got more than one display on the front panel. I bet the front panel of that rig fills up half of a bench. Is that true, Steve? KD2HUC, KD2RW. Careful on the audio.
Nick, that thing had so many buttons and displays on it, I really don't even know where I would start with it. I've been lucky to figure out how to turn the power on it. But, you know what, I'm gonna see if I can find it. I'll send you a link so you can ooh and ah at it yourself. It was, like I said, it was probably one of the most impressive radios I've ever seen. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, I heard Eric and somebody else with one last comment. Eric, my guess is you're on the way back, if you're not already back from Dayton. I've already talked to Kent, the B5EJB, who told me that Friday and Saturday he had rain, cold weather, a little bit of wind, and it's a little bit lower in attendance, possibly because of the weather. Hopefully you found some DMR equipment, and you found some other great buys in Dayton. So tell us anything of the above, Eric. KE2EJ, where are you? KQIW in the TechNet?
KQIW, KE2EJ. I got back about 10 minutes ago. We just unloaded the truck. Now I'm heading over to the TV station to look at something that they called me about while I was over there. Yeah, actually, Friday was quite nice. It was quite warm, and it didn't start raining until after it closed. And then Saturday was a little bit cold. It wasn't a little bit cold, it was quite cold. A bit rainy, but it wasn't all that bad. We did come back with a DMR repeater, or rather, the predecessor to the DMR repeater. We picked up an MPR 2000, which is an analog machine, and we ordered the conversion kit to convert it to a 3000. So we've got our DMR repeater. Although, interesting, you were talking about HF radios that were expensive. At the other end of the spectrum, there's a really nice, I forget the manufacturer's name, there's a really nice HF kit, actually. A really high quality HF machine. Let me let it drop. And there's an import company that is now importing Chinese HF radios. It's very cute, relatively inexpensive, although I'd probably wait a while before grabbing my hands on one, because as you know, it takes a little while for them to get their software right and everything. All in all, it was a good trip. There's a lot of interesting stuff. A few people walk away with some real bargains from the junk pile, so to speak. People bought repeaters. Actually, there's another group that bought a bunch of Master 3s, although I checked it out once we got hold of it. It's got a particular problem, but nothing that can't be taken care of. K2RW, K2J.
With all of the past experience, knowledge, and test equipment you have access to, Eric, there's no such thing as a lemon. You can fix anything. So buying a piece of equipment that is in non-working or not quite working condition. It's been thrown down a flight of stairs and the corners of it are dented. You can get a real good bargain as I see it. I am guessing you left Dayton a little bit after noontime today in order to drive about 9 hours to get home. Is that roughly what it was like? And these inexpensive Chinese-made HF rigs, is it the HF equivalent of a Baofeng or a Waxon? And are they being sold for $150? KE2EJ, K2LIW in the tech net?
Well, they do look like they're a couple of notches better than a Baofeng. They're very small. They're actually a little bit tinier than the H17. They have a really nice display. As far as the pricing goes, I don't think that's been set yet. You know, they've been showing them. They didn't give a price list. Although I'm sure in the next month or two, the ad will show up in QIC and other magazines. Looks really nice. By the way, there are quite a number of other HF manufacturers besides Pentax. You know, the K stuff, the Flex Radio. There was one foreign manufacturer, I didn't spend much time looking at it because I was busy doing other things, which looks like it's a Windows-based HF radio, where you literally can do your computing on it, besides using it as an HF radio. It's in a box like an HF radio, with the knobs and everything else. But the display screen is literally a computer screen built into the box. It has a waterfall. It shows, I think, 300 or 400 kilohertz in their pan adapter, and then they have a 1 megahertz wide version display, and another one that's wider, but the Flex radio kind of takes the cake. They can display 7 megahertz of bandwidth all at once, which is pretty cool, although I don't know what the HF is needed for, but, you know, and then there was all the usual stuff, so, you know, of course I brought a service monitor with me so we could check out the stuff that we bought. H-R-I-W page again.
Great stuff, Eric. The service monitor you have, when it's used in the receiving spectrum analyzer mode, make a guess, what is its front-end sensitivity? Many a spectrum analyzer, if you don't put a preamp in front of it, starts off at around 30 decibels of noise trigger. Therefore, to connect it directly to an antenna on a VHF, UHF frequency to try to make a measurement of local man-made noise, it's not so easy to be done. So your service monitor, what's your guess as to its unaided front-end noise figure or sensitivity? KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Now, the one that I brought with me is, I wouldn't consider the receiver. You probably want something like 50 or 100 microvolts to be nice, as far as the noise figure goes. I would say the noise floor of the thing is around minus 60, minus 70, not that great. But the other one that I have that I didn't bring with me, that actually has a receiver option in it, and it's made by Hewlett Packard, and it goes down to like minus 100. It's rated to go to minus 110, but I wouldn't believe it. Actually, the digital signal analyzer that I have has a noise floor of about 118, which is really nice. It's very clean. And there's an option that you can get that takes it down to like minus 130 or 135, something like that. But, you know, that's the 40 grand box that we bought for work, so. And that goes up to 12 gigs, so that's different animal, different game. The IFR that I bought with me doesn't have the receiver option, so it's not that great.
Yeah, if your barefoot service monitor has a sensitivity of 50 or 100 microvolts, that's a 40 or 45 decibel noise figure. So at VHF frequencies, you're not going to measure noise coming down the antenna very easily with that. Yes, with radiometry techniques, you can dig into that noise, you can make some measurements. but it's not a direct measurement. It's a bit of a pain to do things that way. And so a 20, 30, or 40 dB pre-amplifier in front of that would certainly help its sensitivity. Now you've got to be super careful about what's the peak power output of that pre-amplifier, because I think the when you're using it in the receiver mode, you have essentially a mixer front end, and you could rather easily blow that mixer if you hit it with a peak envelope of 1 volt. I think you'd blow that mixer. Are these approximately the right numbers, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Now, the one thing you have to realize is that commercial service monitors have two inputs. One input which you are going to hook up directly to your repeater or your duplexer or your receiver, which is going to be attached to an attenuator that is accurately marked off. And, you know, it splits it up and the generator and the dummy load is literally connected together so you can do stuff with it. And they also have another input, which is called the antenna input, so local monitoring of the signal, so you can look at it on the spectrum analyzer, measure deviation, and all that kind of stuff, while connected to the antenna. So, you kind of get both worlds. And, you can generate a signal at 0.1 of a microvolt, and still put 100 watts into the same spigot, not worry about blowing it up. The antenna input, I think, the maximum level that you can stick in it is about 100 millivolts or 150 millivolts, something like that. K2RW, K2K.
And you see with a comment.
Steve, recognize that certainly sounds like a mixer front end, which you can blow if it can't take more than 150 millivolts or so. The mixer front end that we have, the doubly balanced mixer, that was the front end device on the AIL spectrum analyzer, could tolerate for a very brief period of time 1.0 volts, a spike of 1.0 volts going into the front end connector with the RF attenuator set at zero. Beyond that, you got a fairly expensive repair of replacing the front end doubly balanced mixer. KE2HUC, give us any information on all of the above, Steve, and where is your threshold of expenses? Would you feel comfortable buying a $15,000 transceiver? KE2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Come and join.
Well, Dick, actually, I'm very happy to report to you that the price of the radio that I was talking to you about has come down. It's still listing for $17,000, but now it's you can save $4,000. And they're offering it for a mere $13,000. So, I don't know. If you check your email, I sent you a link to it. Tell me what you think. I think it'd make a fine addition to your shack. I'd have to take a second mortgage for it. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, every piece of test equipment I own, every piece of electronics I own, ham radio, test equipment, everything, every bit of it was bought used. I'm trying to think, did I ever buy anything brand new? Not a sizable, you know, transceiver, receiver, spectrum analyzer, general coverage receiver, R7000, whatever. Everything I've got is used. And by the way, all of you guys that are listening, Eric in particular, I should know this and I don't. It happened to me once before. My Kenwood 811, which is equivalent to a Kenwood 711A, 2-meter all mode, but it happens to be a 450 all mode, has suddenly flipped itself into a mode that when I turn it on, it gives me 4 beeps over and over again. Beep, 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 beep. I can press any button on the front panel, any button in combination, any button in combination while turning it on and off. Some kind of a reset is required. I haven't found the manual that I've hidden away somewhere. So I wonder, Eric, if you happen to know what's going crazy with my 811, TS-811A, that's making it do that, and it receives nothing. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. 33J. Well, I can't help you with that particular model of radio, but the Acers I know pretty well. Sometimes they go into this failure mode. So it's not exactly the same thing as you're saying, but something similar. Whereas the microprocessor just goes into a loop where it watches all the time and just keeps trying to reset it, and it never recovers because there's a failure, you know, a peripheral chip or something like that. I know in the Acers there's certain button combinations when you turn it on that forces it to a what you call a first birthday, a clean reset, empties all of the memories, starts fresh and new. And when you do that, sometimes it works, and sometimes you get a radio where you know you're going to have to open it up and fix it.
I'm reasonably sure that there's a lithium battery in there that holds up the memory when it's unplugged. And that lithium battery, in my case, must be 20-some-odd years old. I think the rig was built in 1990. I don't think the lithium battery's ever been changed. So when that lithium battery goes dead, of course you lose all your memories. But I'd like to believe that the ROM will still load the program and the buttons on the front panel will still work. Have you heard of failure modes of rigs? I know, there's rigs where the hold on program is in a RAM that's going to be held up with a battery. I think the TS 711 or 811A is not of that ilk. So when that lithium battery goes dead, is that one of the things that would give me this reaction? And so when I find the manual, I'd like to believe there's a button inside I can press, or a combination of buttons on the front panel when you turn it on and off, that will do a overall reset. KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
KQIW, KQJ. From what you're telling me, it sounds like the radio you have is quite a number of years old. If you go back a few years, the microprocessor had the firmware in not EEPROM, but in ROM within the microprocessor itself, where they manufactured the microprocessor with the program in it. If the radio is firmware upgradable, then that's another story, and that would be a much later version that would be based on flash memory. In that case, that would be something where if it gets messed up, something overwrote one of the cells, and the program would never start, you'd never be able to use the button. But in the old stuff, you could lose a battery, and actually most of them were mercury batteries, not lithium. Like a 2032 or something like that, a single cell. There, like in the Acers, if you lose the battery, when you turn it on, it's like a fresh spanking new radio, and you program the memory, and then you turn it off, it all goes away. But the radio still works every time you turn it on.
KE2KV,
Yeah, KV, I'm going to go to you in a second. Show Bob, going back, they become a little quick. Back to you, Eric.
The coin cells, you can still get coin cells, Actually, they haven't changed that. They still use them in a lot of things, so they're available.
Okay, the person with information, and hopefully you've got some experience with Kenwood 711 and 811. Give me your call and name, sir, and your information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is KE2KB, Kilo Echo Team, Kilo Bravo. Name is Frank, and I've been on here once before just with a comment. I found the TS811A manual online. If you want to go to it, it's free. www.radiomanual.info/PMI/CHEMI/TS811A.user.pdf. And you'll find the manual there. But my first guess was also the battery, that backup battery.
Very fine, Frank. Glad you gave us that information. And Frank, you could use quite a bit of audio. Your audio is a little bit low, and a little bit of hiss in the background. Good information. That's a fairly long email address. Did you find that by doing a Google search on TS811A manual? Is that how you You found that one, Frank? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did do. And the audio, it might be low because I might be on FM narrow. I'm running the Yaesu FT60R, and I think I have it set to narrow FM. Is that not the right setting?
Yeah, almost all of these modern day FM transistor, I mean, these handheld radios, particularly the Baofeng and Waksong versions, you have to use them in what it says FM wide, and even the wide is narrow because they're starting to comply with the new FCC mandate on all commercial radios. They're not using a 5kc of deviation anymore, they're using 2.5 in order to save channel spacing. And so these rigs come out with rather narrow audio, unfortunately. There's a whole bunch of websites with people telling you how to make modifications to improve it, but none of them are a glamour fix. So you might want to try FM wide, and later on come back and go to FM wide and give us a transmission. I think you're going to find out you might already be in FM wide, Frank. KE2, Kilo Bravo, K2RIW, go ahead, Frank.
I'm trying to set it up. It's this is the Yaesu FT60R that I'm running. Yeah, I'll come back in a little bit and I'll figure out which is the wide to see what happens. Because I normally use it on narrow to listen to public service band radio because that usually is much lower in audio content than amateur radio is. So I probably have it set up that way for all my bands.
Go right ahead, Eric.
The Yaesu for many years, the older radios, they had a now and a wide setting. The wide setting was actually 15 kilohertz, and now it's only 5, so. Not like the Baofeng, not like the new stuff. I think the 60R has been around for quite a while. I know like the 857, the 847, a couple other radios, they're 15 and 5.
That coin cell battery that's in there, if I'm going to measure that voltage, what voltage should I see if it's good, and what voltage will I likely see if it's bad, if you happen to know, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Oh, most of the radios I've ever seen and worked on are 3 volts. I haven't seen any coin cells that they use at 1.5, but it's probable.
Yeah, lithium would be 3 volts. Are mercuries also in the 3 volt region? Eric, go ahead.
Mercuries come in different forms, like hearing aid batteries. Mercury hearing aid batteries would be actually 1.25. And they make them where they're layered, where they're actually 2 cells put together.
Very fine. I'll soon find out. Wes wanted to make a comment on all of the above. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, N2XJN. There are two interesting radios on ham version. One of them is DV4 model. It's manufactured by Wireless Holding LLC. Those guys are 4 years in business and support tri-bands, which is 220, 144, and 70 centimeters, and all of the modes, C4 FM, D-Star, DMR Plus, DM, DPMR, P25, it's a commercial. But there is a version of P25 that Eric might know better. I believe it's called NXDN. And voice over TE and, of course, FM. So this one is interesting, but also the news is about Kenwood. Kenwood was traditionally not with D-Star, and all of a sudden Kenwood decided that they're going to go for tri-bander as well, which is a handheld. and all modes, including S, SB, and CW, and D star. So that will be 144 to 24430. Back to you.
Did you mention it was wireless holding you were talking about?
That is correct.
Yeah, that radio will be available at the end of the last quarter of the year. Quite a different number of different formats, so. Well, it's going to be expandable, just like anything else. It's all built around there. And I was going to have
Eric, make a rough guess if you can. How many amateurs were at Dayton this year? And was a little bit lower than normal? KE2EJ, K2REW?
Well, in terms of what I saw and the number of people there, and how full the parking lots were, it was pretty much like last year, but I heard from someone, I don't know if it's true, that they were actually expecting, or they had an increase this year, but I don't know what the real story is, so I can't answer that for you.
If you had to make a guess, do you think it was in the vicinity of 20,000 people?
I would probably say easily because I was late to the game this year. I wasn't going to go, and then it was like maybe, so I decided I'd do what I could find in terms of hotels. Forget it, you couldn't find any hotels, but eventually went because somebody else switched it around and shared their room with me.
So I think you're saying lodging was all booked solid until you went 20 miles in some direction. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
And it was more than 20 miles. It was more like 35 miles.
So it sounds to me like you had to sleep on somebody's floor with your sleeping bag. Is that approximately what happened, Eric?
No, actually. I slept in a bed. The guy that I went with actually had originally booked a single bed, but the lady at the desk was really wild. I mean, she called up somebody that had the double room, you know, the double bedroom. And they hadn't arrived yet and asked them if, you know, a room with a king-size bed would do for them. They said yes, and we wound up with a room with two beds, so I didn't have to sleep on the floor.
Well done. Were you there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Eric?
No, if you call leaving in the morning Sunday, you could count that as Sunday. No, we got there Thursday night, and we were there Friday and Saturday. Really there. My legs hurt so much from walking. Forever, all day.
I think I heard somebody tell me it takes more than a day to cover the whole flea market. And did you fly or drive? I'm guessing you might have flown.
No. Bernie flew. A couple other people flew, but no, we drove.
Yeah, hopefully the TSA is not as heavy out there in Dayton, since it is essentially the Dayton Air Base, Wright-Patterson. The airport and Wright-Patterson are essentially one of the same place. Okay.
The pay something.
Go right ahead, Eric.
On Saturday night, we all got together at Outback. We had our dinner. And we came out, looked up in the sky, and there was this series of lights that looked like they were almost stationary, with a red blinking light under the bottom. The solar, what is it called? The solar something one that started off on the west coast, making its way east. It was actually coming in for a landing at the Dayton International Airport. It was really cool. I thought it was a blimp at first, but it turned out to actually be that plane.
And Kent, WA5VJB, told me he also observed that airplane. I believe that airplane under solar power is in the process of circumnavigating the whole world. I think it's about to fly around the whole world, Eric. Back to you.
That is correct. And when we went to the actual website, it showed what the percentage of charge in the batteries were when they landed. It was at 97%, but they had only taken off from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
So it sounds to me like you were watching it land at sundown. I presume that you're not flying across the nighttime.
10 o'clock at night.
Wow. So you had enough charge left over, 95% at 10 o'clock at night. In theory, they could almost fly 24 hours if they go real careful in the batteries. Is that true?
From what I understand, what I read, yes, that's true. As they go across from the United States, they go to Iceland. Iceland, I forget. I think it was Iceland. And from there, they go to Scotland, and then keep going.
I think it has already flown from Hawaii to the west coast of the United States. It's already flown across the Pacific, and I suspect that's essentially a 24-hour or more flight, is it not?
Yes, it is. You know, that wingspan is like over 200 feet. I think 225 feet. And it doesn't fly very fast. I mean, the fact that it was in the sky, it looked like it was just stationary. And it took a long time from the point where we saw it, which may have been about, I guess, 20, 25 miles from the airport, until it landed. So, yeah.
Make a guess, Eric. How many lights were along that leading edge that you were seeing? Go ahead.
I think we counted it. I think it was like 10. But anyway, it looks really cool. If you go to the Google Solar, I think it's Solar Explorer 1, I forget the correct name. Or you could do a solar powered aircraft. It'll bring you up to the site. They have all sorts of pictures of it at night and during the day. And it looks really cool.
Do you happen to know who is sponsoring that operation, Eric? Go ahead.
When you look at the aircraft itself, there's like a dozen sponsors on it, so I don't think it's any one individual group. I think the spokesperson, even though she was speaking English, you could tell she's a French person. So I guess it's a combination of ingredients. You'll have to go to the site and look it up. I really can't tell you what the story is.
In the early days, the Rutan brothers in California, AeroViron, in the Mojave Desert, was doing some of that operation. Who was the designer of this particular aircraft, if you happen to know? Go ahead.
I can't give you, I bet that Paul could probably give you better information on that. Again, go to the website and I'm sure everything's listed there, so I'm not the authority on this.
Okay, we're looking forward to Paul, he might have some info on that. Time for the mailbag, we're quite late. Just like I said. So are they going to stump us tonight, John? What kind of deep questions in physics and science did you get so far? KC2WGB, K2RIW in TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Paul, everyone on the net. They're real simple tonight. I have a couple of nice questions here. Something often wondered myself. Well, first of all, I'm going to take this gentleman who has a... he has an amplifier he's working on, and it has 3-500s. They're glass. Okay. He has approximately a 50-volt differential. These tubes are in parallel. The plate circuit is down about 50-60 volts on one tube, and he has a question. Let me let it drop. He has checked the bias. He has checked the grid resistors. It's grounded grid type, and the drive is equal on both tubes, but that voltage is low. His question is, can he exchange the plate caps? He already tried swapping the tubes, and he gets the same position, the same drop, voltage drop on the same tube position. So what he wants to know is, can he switch the plate caps and operate it? Would that be safe? What does he have to look out for? And he's in the middle of troubleshooting this thing. It's driving him nuts. So back to you, Dick. Maybe you have some tips for him. KC2WGB.
Probably the chunks.
pair of 3-500 tubes, you and I would put those two tubes in parallel. There's a slim chance that this particular design is using them in push-pull. In either case, I guess the voltage should be the same on both. But what's the chances of them being push-pull? And if it is push-pull and you switch the two plate caps, the so-called negative feedback for neutralization becomes positive feedback, or vice versa, and it might not be right. Do you know of any push-pull HF amplifiers with a pair of 3-500s? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
K2LAW, K2EJ. I've seen 811 where they have pairs of 811s in push-pull. Actually, two in parallel. But to put that together, it's not an easy task. So. As a general rule, I don't think so. I think they're in parallel.
There's a way of telling if they're in parallel. You start off at the two plate caps. Most likely, the very first thing you run into are these parasitic suppressing chokes, which is really a few turns of wire with a great big 2-watt resistor inside of it. And then those two parasitic chokes, most of the time, come together to a common point that then goes to the Pi network. That would be pretty strong confirmation.
That's why I suggested the chokes in the first place.
Exactly. So if that wire wound around that resistor has broken contact, and you're now using nothing but that dropping resistor, first of all, that resistor is going to run quite a bit hotter, and that would accommodate that would account for the 50 volts of extra drop. So by studying that circuit, you should be able to tell fairly fast, is it push-pull or parallel? If it's parallel, you can reverse the two. But I think the next step really should be with turn off all the power and unplug it, make sure the high voltage capacitors are thoroughly discharged, then put your ohm meter across each of those parasitic chokes. You should see essentially 0 ohms with your ohm meter across those parasitic chokes. That's the easiest way I can think of getting a 50 volt differential. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Did he say it was grounded grid?
Yes, he did. But I think even in grounded grid, you'd still be running them in parallel, wouldn't you, Eric? Go ahead.
Anyway, with grounded grid, I would think you would more likely be running them in parallel rather than push-pull. I've never seen that.
It's not impossible, but it would take a lot of extra circuitry to do it. The advantage of push-pull is that it suppresses the even harmonics. So, your harmonic output of the amplifier requires less filtering.
I've seen a broadcast that it would tetrize the push-pull.
Oh, I believe that. And I think the only reason you go push-pull is to suppress the even harmonic. Other than that, it's an awful lot of work for not very much benefit. Is that the way you see it, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I do. But when you're talking about a broadcast transmitter, and you're talking about those kind of parallels, every little bit of help is totally worth it.
Yeah, because those great big filters that you guys have to use in order to meet broadcast standards for undesired frequency outputs, those bandpass and frequency reject filters,
smaller.
Don't they get pretty massive? Don't they fill up a quarter of a room in some cases? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, they do. I mean, when you talk about television, it gets a little better. Actually, when I think about it, just for a signal to the 4CX24000, the diplexing filters and the bandpass filters took up the whole freaking wall.
Are we talking about something like 30 cubic feet of stuff that's doing all that filtering? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was at VHF. But your HF is a different story. I mean, you've been to my place. The mass filter that I use, which is a 6 megahertz bandpass filter, it looks like 3 55-gallon drums bolted together with the 3-inch coax going in and out.
I bet those filters are pretty pricey. If you buy
buy that filter brand new, what are we talking about, 20 grand? Yeah, in some cases a little more, depends on the power level. You gotta remember that the things like broadcast transmitters, or even broadcast TV cameras, or in the old days, a tape recorder, how many are you gonna sell? You're gonna spend maybe $3, $5, $8 million developing the device. And you're gonna sell, you know, maybe 1,000, 2,000, like, you know, the whole world only has something like 2,800 television stations. Not everybody's going to buy the same thing from the same manufacturer, so you've got to at least break even. Forget about making a profit, and that's why a broadcast camera with a lens might cost you $100,000 for a, you know, period back. That's a lot cheaper now, but the glass is still expensive. A typical broadcast that is buy from Rode, and they make a nice VHS that we're going to put up at the New World Trade. You know, you might be talking about 750,000.
A little bit pricey. Almost everybody in television these days, over-the-air broadcast, is digital. Roughly how many analog stations are left? Are they all low power? Are some of them going to persist for a while? What's the status of analog television over-the-air broadcast? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2IW, K2K. The only analogs that are left are those who have a SDA and a variant. Usually, economically, they can't afford the upgrade. But all that is coming to an end. Actually, you may not be aware, but right now, 125 megahertz of the broadcast band is being auctioned off. The auction is occurring now. The concept is that they're going to repack all the stations into the remaining bit of spectrum. So those analogs and the low powers that are out there and the translators have been left out of this mix, and they may be, you know, pure out of luck that they could even be on the air after this auction is over, and we have yet to see what's going to happen. K2IW, K2K, and the FCC just wants to make over-the-air broadcasts disappear to the earth.
I still don't think they can do that, Eric. They're certainly going to make me unhappy because I have never paid a dime for television reception. I've always done everything over the air. Channel 17 on Long Island, I don't know where it's located. I believe it's a low-power analog station. Who is the intended audience? Is it economically viable to keep that station on the air, Eric? Particularly because it seems to be an exact duplicate of Channel 55. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Are you talking the analog that looks like 55?
The programming is identical to 55, but it really is on frequency 17, to my knowledge. Or at least that's the advertised channel number. So what's called Channel 17 seems to be a very low-power AM television station. I should know, and I don't know what frequency it's on. And who is its intended audience? Who is it servicing, as opposed to 55? Over to you, Eric.
Okay. 55 has a digital transmitter in Ridge. There was a low-power of 55 that was analog. I don't know where it was. You know, there's a 1212 in Amityville, believe it or not. There's a channel 20 in Plainview, which I actually take care of. You might be able to pick up. And then each audience is like, I take care of a transmitter with direct require base station, which is part of the auction app, on Empire. It's on channel 36, and it's aimed specifically at West New York, where there's a large Indian population. They have mostly its programs there. So there are niches. The one in Illuminated Drop Space. One in Plainview is actually the Seventh Day Adventist in their programming. It's something called the Hope Channel. There's also a Spanish version of it. That's digital. Their intended audience is that particular group of Seventh-day Adventists sparse them out more or less. The population is. It's beamed east and it's beamed south, but it's not beamed to the west at all. It's only 700 watts, but you know, it's on Elliott's power. It's put out a good punch. And there's a couple of other translators out there, so the individual organizations that are behind them are the ones that support them. Once you've got the license, you basically just have to put programming into it and pay for electricity. It's the rental of your state. People are IWK to here.
Yeah, this low-power AM station that I'm discussing that I can watch, it is branded as 17. I don't know what frequency it's really on. And at least 95% of the time, if not more, the programming is identical to 55.
Yeah, I said analog 17. It's really on 17.
It's really on 17, and I think it's AM. Is that not true? I think it is non-digital, and my converter has to go through some kind of a gyration in order to get it. I think it's flipping itself from digital to analog. So you're saying that branded 17 is a real 17. Got a guess as to how many watts and what city is it located in?
Now I can look it up. I'm not sure where it is. I know it exists. It's not supposed to exist, I think, after September, October, something like that. You know, 55 is owned by CBS. The guy who owned 55, CBS made him an offer he couldn't refuse, so he retired a very rich person. And actually, they were going to put a transmitter at my site, but of course CBS had actually filed for a secondary transmitter on channel 22. But since they bought 55, that kind of went out the window. So, you know, that's why they bought it. The transmitters were already in place. They were ready on cable. It gave them an opportunity to put the secondary programming, which is, you know, other newscasts and other programs that used to be on Channel 2 and are now on 55, et cetera, so on and so forth. It made more sense for them to do that than to put up another transmitter here.
You said 55 was bought by CBS. Is that Charlie Victor Sierra, or is it Charlie Bravo Sierra? And that Channel 17 AM low power, do you have a guess as to what audience is that serving? Two questions there, Eric. Go ahead.
All right. Well, the point of the low-power translator really is to give you coverage in areas where your main system doesn't reach. Remember that 55, which is on, I forget what channel they're on, way out in Ridge, and when they wanted to cover more westerly areas, that's where the translator came into play. So they're basically looking to give themselves coverage where they don't have any because you can't pick up their main signal. And the CBS is the Columbia Broadcasting System, which is owned by Viacom, which has now been spun off into its own entity called CBS Incorporated.
What is branded as Channel 2 is also CBS. I presume they're strongly related. And the Channel 55 out in...
Same company.
Makes sense. The Channel 55 out in Ridge, I think it's really on frequency 56. There, I'm not sure. Or 54. It's one channel away, as I remember. And of the channels, of the frequencies that are being resold, does that mean everything above, let me pick a number, channel 56, no longer exists? Is there a channel number above which the spectrum is being sold and everybody squeezed into the lower frequencies? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
All right, first of all, 55 is not on 56, they're on 30-something, I forget, 40-something. 55 actually became part of the, what do you call it, now defunct. They were transmitting TV to cell phones and other receivers and don't know why I can't remember the name of it. It's very famous. Oh, when the FCC gets done, there won't be anything above 36 or 38, something like that. You know, leaving the space for the radio astronomy. And then all that upper stuff is the 700 megahertz band. Which, by the way, the cell phone people are out of their minds because it's particularly noisy. I've been talking to a couple people who are doing studies on it. They admit it. It's noisy. It's going to make some difficulty for them amongst the manufacturers and the cell phone providers. I forgot where I was going. Sorry.
Yeah, I think the cell phone system called the 5G or 6G, sixth generation, whichever it is, they're promising numbers like a gigabit of data rate to portable handheld devices. Gigabit to uplink and downlink. It seems to be what they're seeking. Boy, it's going to take a lot of infrastructure to do that. So this LTE jazz starting at 700 megs and going up, boy, they're going to use up every one of those frequencies for these Wi-Fi-like systems. And so there's obviously a lot of demand for that. 6.8 billion cell phones in use on planet Earth right now, and as you've heard me say a few times, there are considerably more people in the world with an operating cell phone in their hand by comparison to the number of people who have access to a working toilet. Cell phones are more valuable than toilets. KE2EJ, that says something. K2RIW.
K2RIW station, Jay. I can still picture the name of this system. If I can come up with it, just recognize it. It was done by Qualcomm. They used they brought up all the Channel 55 stations, their frequencies. I think it was like 8 or 10 years ago, and put up the Channel 55 transmitters anyway. Because the condensing of the TV bands, there are certain holdovers, like my NJTV station in the one in Warren is on channel 51, which is outside the current allocation with the reductions that were made before. There was nothing higher than channel 50. And there's a whole bunch of space there that T-Mobile and some other people are supposed to be using, but they can't because the station is still on 51, and in terms of having it moved, there's an awful lot of stuff going on with the FCC, where they put it on hold because of the auction and the packing, and so there's some oddball cases out there. That's what I want to say. And ATSC-3 is coming. The standard is almost finalized at this point. And what essentially that means is that your converter is going to be useless.
Well, I'm using a Vizio television these days. Maybe you're telling me I'm going to have to buy another set. I wasn't using my Radio Shack converter, although I'm about to go back to the Radio Shack converter because it's got functions that I really like that I can't get on my Vizio. For one thing, I need a pair of binoculars in order to read what's on the screen when I go to the mode when it gives me information. New Jersey TV, NJTV, brands itself as 50. I think you're saying it might really be 51, but it's branded as 50. I watch it all the time. Very nice.
You're only watching one of four stations.
Okay. I don't know which. It is branded as 50. It's branded as NGTV and TBS. And I think I'm getting it from New Jersey. You're telling me I'm getting it from somewhere else, Eric, go ahead.
There's NJTV in Camden, there's NJTV in Warren, there's NJTV in, it's not Morristown, I forget now. And then there's another one in the northern part of New Jersey. There's actually four NJTV transmitters. You're only watching one of them, which happens to be on channel 50. There's another one that's on 51 that you're not picking up, and there's another one on 52 somewhere.
Is the 15th branding that I'm watching, is it really coming from Empire State Building?
Coming from Bloomfield, New Jersey, that's where it is.
How high is that tower, and how is it giving me such a strong signal 50 miles out here on Long Island?
No, let's go the other way. I have a transmitter here in Plainview, and the Comcast head end in somewhere way out, Bolton, I think it is, they pick us up no problem. And specifically, I know the Warren site pretty well. Bloomfield site, I don't know. I suspect it's similar, where they got like a 150-foot tower on the side of the mountain, and, you know, your antenna can see its antenna, plus your antenna is, 50 feet off the ground?
It should be. It once was. It will be again. Right now, my television aerial is on the chimney of my house, 25 feet or so above the ground, but my ground is close to 300 feet above sea level, carefully selected for that reason. But, I've got to put my television aerial back up on a tower where I can do some more television DXing like Joe does.
Well, all you need is a rotator point and mop.
Yeah, I've got to finish some construction here before I can really do all of that. Although I could put it on one of my other structures. Yeah, I've got some catching up to do. Your channel 21, branded 21, I think it's really on 21. Wasn't it on 22 at one time, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, when I was running two transmitters, I had an analog transmitter that was 1.78 megawatts in ERP, and I also had on channel 22 a digital transmitter with an ERP of 95 kilowatts. So, yes, and since the analogs went away, the digital got moved to 21. So 21 is actually on 21.
Is 31, the station that I watch, it's branded as 31, is it really on 31?
What is actually 31?
Is 33 really on 33?
You're talking about MeTV?
Roger, Dodger.
That's on VHF channel 3, believe it or not.
I'm having trouble believing that. UHF, channel 3 digital, which would be blasted by all of the 60-cycle power line noise in my neighborhood.
Don't believe me, I don't care.
I'm having trouble on that one, Eric. Anything that low in frequency digital really cannot tolerate the impulse noise that you get from arcing over a power line noise. There are very few lower VHF channels these days.
You should take a HF radio, stick it in your car, drive under the LED lights and tell me what you think.
Oh, some of them are very noisy, I know what you're saying. And of all this excess noise that Eric is now experiencing, do you have a guess as to what he's eventually going to find is causing a, let's call it 28 dB of excess noise in his neighborhood? Over to you, Eric.
There's a lot of sources. By the way, the MeTV transmitter is on 4 times the square, so when I go up there, I walk right past it.
What real frequency channel number is it on, Eric?
3, as in 1, 2, 3.
Boy, I'm having trouble with that. I'm going to do some checking. I get it much too well. There are certain frequencies that fade out on me pretty frequently under certain band conditions. And lower VHF 3, I'm having trouble believing it would survive so well. We'll soon find out. I know we've got very far afield of the original question here, John, but finish me off on the question if we've forgotten some of the details, and if you think we've covered it well enough, that amplifier, I think, is going to be parallel when he checks it. And I think if he puts his ohm meter across that RF